A screech of brakes, a horn. Bob Arctor looked swiftly up at the night traffic. A sports car, engine running by the curb. Inside it, a girl waving at him. Donna. Christ, he said again. He strode toward the curb. Opening the door of her MG, Donna said, Did I scare you? I passed you on my way to your place, and then I flashed on it that it was you trucking along, so I made a U-turn and came back. Get in. Silently, he got in and shut the car door. Why are you out roaming around? Donna said. Because of your car? It's still not fixed? I just did a freaky number, Bob Arctor said. Not like a fantasy trip, just... He shuddered. Donna said, I have your stuff. What? He said. 1,000 tabs of death. Death? He echoed. Yeah, high-grade death. I better drive. She shifted into low, took off and out onto the street. Almost at once she was driving along too fast. Donna always drove too fast and tailgated, but expertly. That fucking Barris, he said. You know how he works? He doesn't kill anybody he wants dead. He just hangs around until a situation arises where they die. And he just sits there while they die. In fact, he sets them up to die while he stays out of it. But I'm not sure how. Anyhow, he arranges to allow them to fucking die. He lapsed into silence then, brooding to himself. Like, he said, Barris wouldn't wire plastic explosives into the ignition system of your car. No, what he'd do... Do you have the money, Donna said, for the stuff? It's really primo, and I need the money right now. I have to have it tonight because I have to pick up some other things. Sure, he had it in his wallet. I don't like Barris, Donna said as she drove, and I don't trust him. You know, he's crazy, and when you're around him, you're crazy too. And then, when you're not around him, you're okay. You're crazy right now. I am, he said, startled. Yes, Donna said calmly. Well, he said, Jesus. He did not know what to say to that, especially since Donna was never wrong. Hey, Donna said with enthusiasm. Could you take me to a rock concert at the Anaheim Stadium next week, could you? Right on, he said mechanically. And then it flashed on him what Donna had said, asking him to take her out. All right, he said, pleased. Life flowed back into him. Once again, the little dark-haired chick whom he loved so much had restored him to caring. Oh, which night? Well, it's Sunday afternoon. I'm going to bring some of that oily dark hash and get really loaded. They won't know the difference. There'll be thousands of heads there. She glanced at him critically. But you gotta wear something neat, not those funky clothes you sometimes put on. I mean, her voice softened. I want you to look foxy, because you are foxy. Okay, he said, charmed. I'm taking us to my place, Donna said as she shot along through the night in her little car. And you do have the money, and you will give it to me, and then we'll drop a few of the tabs and kick back and get really mellow. And maybe you'd like to buy us a fifth of Southern Comfort and we can get bombed as well. Oh, wow, he said, with sincerity. What I really genuinely want to do tonight, Donna said as she shifted down and swiveled the car onto her own street and into her driveway, is go to a drive-in movie. I bought a paper and read what's on, but I couldn't find anything good except at the Torrance drive-in, but it's already started. It started at 5:30. Bummer. He examined his watch. Oh, then we've missed... No, we could still see most of it. She shot him a warm smile as she stopped the car and shut off the engine. It's all the Planet of the Apes pictures, all 11 of them. They run from 7:30 p.m. all the way through 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. I'll go to work directly from the drive-in, so I'll have to change now. We'll sit there at the movie loaded and drinking Southern Comfort all night. Wow, can you dig it? She peered at him hopefully. All right, he echoed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Donna hopped out and came around to help him open his little door. When did you last see all the Planet of the Apes pictures? I saw most of them earlier this year, but then I got sick toward the last ones and I had the split. It was this ham sandwich they vended me there at the drive-in. That really made me mad. I missed the last picture, where they reveal that all the famous people in history, like Lincoln and Nero, were secretly apes, and running all human history from the start. That's why I want to go back now so bad. She lowered her voice as they walked toward her front door. They burned me by vending that ham sandwich. So what I did, don't rat on me. The next time we went into the drive-in, the one in La Habra, I stuck a bent coin in the slot, and a couple more in other vending machines for good measure. Me and Larry Talling. You remember Larry? I was going with him. We'd done a whole bunch of quarters and 50-cent pieces using his vise and a big wrench. I made sure all the vending machines were owned by the same firm, of course, and then we fucked up a bunch of them. Practically all of them, if the truth were known. She unlocked her front door with her key slowly and gravely in the dim light. It is not good policy to burn you, Donna, he said as they entered her small, neat place. Don't step on the shag carpet, Donna said. Well, where'll I step then? Stand still or on the newspapers. Donna, now don't give me a lot of heavy shit about having to walk on the newspapers. Do you know how much it cost me to get my carpet shampooed? She stood unbuttoning her jacket. Thrift, he said, taking off his own coat. French peasant thrift. Do you ever throw anything away? You keep pieces of string too short for any... Someday, Donna said, shaking her long black hair back as she slid out of her leather jacket. I'm going to get married, and I'll need all that, but I put away. When you get married, you need everything there is. Like, we saw this big mirror in the yard next door. It took three of us over an hour to get it over the fence. Someday, how much of what you've got put away did you buy? He asked. And how much did you steal? Buy? She studied his face uncertainly. What do you mean by buy? Like when you buy dope, he said. A dope deal. Like now, he got out his wallet. I gave you money, right? Donna nodded, watching him obediently, actually more out of politeness, but with dignity, with a certain reserve. And then you hand me a bunch of dope for it, he said, holding out the bills. And what I mean by buy is an extension into the greater world of human business transactions of what we have present now, with us, as dope deals. I think I see, she said, her large dark eyes placid but alert. She was willing to learn. How many, like, when you ripped off that Coca-Cola truck you were tailgating that day, how many bottles of Coke did you rip off? How many crates?
A month's worth, Donna said. For me and my friends.
He glared at her reprovingly.
Well, it's a form of barter, she said.
What do you... He started to laugh. What do you give back?
I give of myself.
Now he laughed out loud.
To who?
To the driver of the truck, who probably had to make good...
The Coca-Cola company is a capitalist monopoly. No one else can make Coke but them, like the phone company does when you want to phone someone. They're all capitalist monopolies. Do you know,
her dark eyes flashed, that the formula for Coca-Cola is a carefully guarded secret handed down through the ages, known only to a few persons all in the same family, and when the last of them dies that's memorized the formula, there will be no more Coke. So there's a backup written formula in a safe somewhere, she added meditatively.
I wonder where.
She ruminated to herself, her eyes flickering.
You and your rip-off friends will never find the Coca-Cola formula, not in a million years.
Who the fuck wants to manufacture Coke anyhow when you can rip it off their trucks? They got a lot of trucks. Don't you see them driving constantly, real slow?
I tailgate them every chance I get. Makes them mad.
She smiled, a secret, cunning, lovely little impish smile at him, as if trying to beguile him into her strange reality, where she tailgated and tailgated a slow truck and got madder and madder and more impatient, and then, when it pulled off, instead of shooting on by like other drivers would, she pulled off too, and stole everything the truck had on it. Not so much because she was a thief, or even for revenge, but because by the time it finally pulled off, she had looked at the crates of Coke so long that she had figured out what she could do with all of them. Her impatience had returned to ingenuity. She had loaded her car, not the MG, but the larger Camaro she had been driving then before she had totaled it, with crates and crates of Coke, and then for a month she and all her jerk friends had drunk all the free Coke they wanted to. And then, after that, she had turned the empties back in at different stores for the deposits. "What did you do with the bottle caps?" he once asked her. "You wrap them in muslin and store them away in your cedar chest?"
"I threw them away," Donna said glumly.
"There's nothing you can do with Coke bottle caps. There's no contests or anything anymore." Now she disappeared into the other room, returned presently with several polyethylene bags.
"You want to count these?" she inquired.
"There's 1,000 for sure. I weighed them on my gram scale before I paid for them."
"It's okay," he said.
He accepted the bags, and she accepted the money, and he thought, "Donna, once more I could send you up, but I probably never will, no matter what you do, even if you do it to me, because there is something wonderful and full of life about you and sweet, and I would never destroy it. I don't understand it, but there it is."
"Could I have 10? She asked.
"Oh, 10? 10 tabs back? Sure." He opened one of the bags. It was hard to untie, but he had the skill, and counted her out precisely 10, and then 10 for himself, and retied the bag, and then carried all the bags to his coat in the closet.
"You know what they do in cassette tape stores now?"
Donna said energetically when he returned. The 10 tabs were nowhere in sight. She had already stashed them.
"Regarding tapes?"
"Oh, they arrest you," he said, "if you steal them."
"No, they always did that. Now what they do, you know when you carry an LP or a tape to the counter and the clerk removes the little price tag that's gummed on? Well, guess what? Guess what I found out almost the hard way."
She threw herself down in a chair, grinning in anticipation, and brought forth a foil-wrapped tiny cube, which he identified as a fragment of hash even before she had unwrapped it.
"That isn't only a gummed-on price sticker. There's also a tiny fragment of some kind of alloy in it. And if that sticker isn't removed by the clerk at the counter, and you try to get out through the door with it, then an alarm goes off."
"How did you find out almost the hard way?"
"Some teeny bopper tried to walk out with one under her coat ahead of me, and the alarm went off, and they grabbed her, and the pigs came."
"How many did you have under your coat?"
3.
"Did you also have dope in your car?" he said. "Because once they got you for the tape rip-off, they'd impound your car because you'd be downtown looking out, and the car would be routinely towed away, and then they'd find the dope and send you up for that, too. I'll bet that wasn't locally, either. I bet you did that where..." He had started to say, "where you don't know anybody in law enforcement who would intervene," but he could not say that, because he meant himself. Were Donna ever busted, at least where he had any pull, he would work his ass off to help her. But he could do nothing, say, up in L.A. County. And if it ever happened, which eventually it would, there it would happen, too far off for him to hear or help. He had a scenario start rolling in his head then, a horror fantasy. Donna, much like Luckman, dying with no one hearing or caring or doing anything. They might hear, but they, like Barris, would remain impassive and inert until for her it was all over. She would not literally die, as Luckman had. Had, he meant might. But she, being an addict to Substance D, would not only be in jail, but she would have to withdraw, cold turkey. And since she was dealing, not just using, and there was a rap for theft as well, she would be in for a while, and a lot of other things, dreadful things, would happen to her. So when she came back out, she would be a different Donna. The soft, careful expression that he dug so much, the warmth, that would be altered into God knew what. Anyhow, something empty and too much used. Donna translated into a thing. And so it went, for all of them, someday. But for Donna, he hoped, far and away beyond his own lifetime. And not where he couldn't help. "Spunky," he said to her now, unhappily. "Without spooky."
"What's that?"
After a moment, she understood.
"Oh, the TA therapy. But when I do hash..."
She'd gotten out her very own little round ceramic hash pipe, like a sand dollar, which she had made herself, and was lighting it.
"Then I'm sleepy."
Gazing up at him, bright-eyed and happy, she laughed and extended to him the precious hash pipe.
"I'll supercharge you," she declared. "Sit down."
As he seated himself, she rose to her feet, stood puffing the hash pipe into lively activity, then waddled at him, bent, and as he opened his mouth, like a baby bird, he thought, as he always thought when she did this, she exhaled great, gray, forceful jets of hash smoke into him, filling him with her own hot and bold and incorrigible energy, which was at the same time a pacifying agent that relaxed and mellowed them both out together. She who supercharged, and Bob Arctor who received.
"I love you, Donna," he said.
This supercharging? This was the substitute for sexual relations with her that he got. And maybe it was better. It was worth so much. It was so intimate and very strange viewed that way. Because first she could put something inside him, and then, if she wanted, he put something into her. An even exchange back and forth until the hash ran out.
"Yeah, I can dig it. You're being in love with me," she said, chuckled, sat down beside him, grinning, to take a hit from the hash pipe now, for herself.
Chapter 9. "Hey, Donna, man," he said, "do you like cats?" She blinked, red-eyed.
"Dripping little things, moving along about a foot above the ground."
"Above? No, on the ground."
"Drippy, behind furniture."
"Little spring flowers, then," he said.
"Yes," she said, "I can dig it. Little spring flowers with yellow in them, when I first come up."
"And before," he said, "before anyone."
"Yes," she nodded, eyes shut, off in her trip. "Before anyone stops them and they're gone."
"You know me," he said. "You can read me." She lay back, setting down the hash pipe. It had gone out.
"No more," she said, and her smile slowly dwindled away.
"What's wrong?" he said.
"Nothing." She shook her head, and that was all.
"Can I put my arms around you?" he said. "I want to hold you, okay? Hug you like, okay?"
Her dark, enlarged, unfocused, weary eyes opened. "No," she said. "No, you're too ugly."
"What?" he said. "No," she said sharply now.
"I snort a lot of coke. I have to be super careful because I snort a lot of coke."
"Ugly?" he echoed, furious at her. "Fuck you, Donna."
"Just leave my body alone," she said, staring at him.
"Sure," he said. "Sure." He got to his feet and backed away.
"You better believe it."
He felt like going out to his car, getting his pistol from the glove compartment and shooting her face off, bursting her skull and eyes to bits. And then that passed, that hash hate and fury.
"Fuck it," he said dismally. "I don't like people to grope my body," Donna said. "I have to watch out for that because I do so much coke. Someday, I have it planned. I'm going over the Canadian border with 4 pounds of coconut in my snatch. I'll say I'm a Catholic and a virgin." "Where are you going?"
Alarm had her now. She half rose. "I'm taking off," he said.
"Your car is at your place. I drove you."
The girl struggled up, tousled and confused and half asleep, wandered toward the closet to get her leather jacket.
"I'll drive you back. You can see why I have to protect my snatch. 4 pounds of coke is worth..."
"No fucking way," he said. "You're too stoned to drive 10 feet, and you never fucking let anybody else drive that little roller skate of yours."
Facing him, she yelled wildly.
"That's because nobody else can fucking drive my car. Nobody else ever gets it right. No man especially. Driving or anything else. You had your hands down into my..."
And then he was somewhere outside in the darkness, roaming, without his coat, in a strange part of town, nobody with him. Fucking alone, he thought, and then he heard Donna hurrying along after him, trying to catch up with him, panting for breath, because she did so much pot and hash these days that her lungs were half silted up with resins. He halted, stood without turning, waiting, feeling really down. Approaching him, Donna slowed, panted. I am dreadfully sorry I've hurt your feelings by what I said. I was out of it. Yeah, he said. Too ugly. Sometimes when I've worked all day and I'm super, super tired, the first hit I take just spaces me. You want to come back or what? You want to go to the drive-in? What about the Southern Comfort? I can't buy it. They won't sell it to me, she said and paused. I'm underage, right? Okay, he said. Together they walked back. That sure is good hash, isn't it? Donna said. Bob Arctor said, it's black, sticky hash, which means it's saturated with opium alkaloids. What you're smoking is opium, not hash. Do you know that? That's why it costs so much. Do you know that? He heard his voice rise. He stopped walking. You aren't doing hash, sweetie. You're doing opium. And that means a lifetime habit at a cost of... what's hash selling for now, a pound? And you'll be smoking and nodding off and nodding off and not being able to get your car in gear and rear-ending trucks and needing it every day before you go to work. I need to now, Donna said. Take a hit before I go to work. End at noon and as soon as I get home. That's why I deal, to buy my hash. Hash is mellow. Hash is where it's at. Opium, he repeated. What's hash sell for now? About $10,000 a pound, Donna said. The good kind. Christ, as much as smack. Oh, I would never use a needle. I never have, and I never will. You last about 6 months when you start shooting, whatever you shoot, even tap water. You get a habit. You have a habit. Donna said, we all do. You take substance D. So what? What's the difference now? I'm happy. Aren't you happy? I get to come home and smoke high-grade hash every night. It's my trip. Don't try to change me. Don't ever try to change me. Me or my morals. I am what I am. And I get off on hash. It's my life. You ever see pictures of an old opium smoker? Like in China in the old days. Or a hash smoker in India now. What they look like later on in life? Donna said, I don't expect to live long. So what? I don't want to be around long. Do you? Why? What's in this world? And have you ever seen... Shit, what about Jerry Fabin? Look at someone too far into substance D. What's there really in this world, Bob? It's a stopping place to the next where they punish us here because we were born evil. You are a Catholic. We're being punished here. So if we can get off on a trip now and then, fuck it. Do it. The other day, I almost cashed in driving my MG to work. I had the 8-track stereo on and I was smoking my hash pipe. And I didn't see this old dude in an 84 Ford Imperator. You are dumb, he said. Super dumb. I am, you know, gonna die early. Anyhow, whatever I do, probably on the freeway. I got hardly any brakes on my MG, you realize that? And I've picked up 4 speeding tickets this year already. Now I gotta go to traffic school. It's a bummer for 6 whole months. So someday, he said, I will all of a sudden never lay eyes on you again, right? Never again. Because of traffic school? No, after the 6 months, in the marble orchard, he explained. Wiped out, before you're allowed under California law, fucking goddamn California law, to purchase a can of beer or a bottle of booze. Yeah, Donna exclaimed, alerted. The Southern Comfort. Right on. Are we going to do a fifth of Southern Comfort and take in the ape flicks? Are we? There's still, like, 8 left, including the one... Listen to me, Bob Arctor said, taking hold of her by the shoulder. She instinctively pulled away. No, she said. He said, you know what they ought to let you do one time? Maybe just one time? Let you go in legally, just once, and buy a can of beer. Why? She said wonderingly. Present to you because you were good, he said. They served me once, Donna exclaimed in delight, at a bar. The cocktail waitress, I was dressed up and, like, with some people, asked me what I wanted, and I said, I'll have a vodka Collins. And she served me. It was at the La Paz, too, which is a really neat place. Wow, can you believe it? I memorized that, the vodka Collins, from an ad. So if I ever got asked at a bar like that, I'd sound cool, right? She suddenly put her arm through his and hugged him as they walked, something she almost never did. It was the most all-time super trip of my life. Then I guess, he said, you have your present, your one present.
Eh, I can dig it, Donna said.
I can dig it. Of course, they told me later, these people I was with, I should have ordered a Mexican drink, like a tequila sunrise, because, see, it's a Mexican kind of bar, there with the La Paz restaurant. Next time I'll know that. I got that taped in my memory banks if I go there again. Know what I'm going to do someday, Bob? I'm going to move north to Oregon and live in the snow. I'm going to shovel snow off the front walk every morning and have a little house and garden with vegetables.
He said, well, you have to save up for that. Save all your money, it costs.
Glancing at him, suddenly shy, Donna said, he'll get me that.
What's his name?
Who?
Well, you know.
Her voice was soft, sharing her secret, imparting to him because he, Bob Arctor, was her friend and she could trust him.
Mr. Wright, I know what he'll be like. He'll drive an Aston Martin and he'll take me north in it. And that's where the little old-fashioned house will be in the snow, north from here.
After a pause, she said, snow's supposed to be nice, isn't it?
He said, don't you know?
Well, I never have been in the snow, except once in San Bredou up in those mountains, and then it was half sleet and muddy and I fucking fell. I don't mean snow like that. I mean real snow.
Bob Arctor, his heart heavy in a certain way, said, you feel positive about all this. It'll really happen?
Well, it'll happen, she nodded. It's in the cards for me.
They walked on then in silence, back to her place to get her MG. Donna, wrapped up in her own dreams and plans. And he recalled Barris and he recalled Luckman, and Hank and the safe apartment, and he recalled Fred.
Hey, man, he said, can I go with you to Oregon when you do take off finally?
She smiled at him, gently and with acute tenderness, with the answer no. And he understood from knowing her that she meant it, and it would not change. He shivered.
Are you cold? She asked.
Yeah, he said, very cold.
I got that good MG heater in my car, she said, for when we're at the drive-in. You're warm up there.
She took his hand, squeezed it, held it, and then, all at once, she let it drop. But the actual touch of her lingered inside his heart. That remained. In all the years of his life ahead, the long years without her, with never seeing her or hearing from her or knowing anything about her, if she was alive or happy or dead or what, that touch stayed locked within him, sealed in himself, and never went away. That one touch of her hand.
He brought a cute little needle freak named Connie home with him that night, to ball her in exchange for him giving her a bag of 10 Mex hits. Skinny and lank-haired, the girl sat on the edge of his bed, combing her odd hair. This was the first time she had ever come along with him. He'd met her at a head party, and he knew very little about her, although he'd carried her phone number for weeks. Being a needle freak, she was naturally frigid, but this wasn't a downer. It made her indifferent to sex in terms of her own enjoyment, but on the other hand, she didn't mind what sort of sex it was. This was obvious just watching her. Connie sat half-dressed, her shoes off, a bobby pin in her mouth, gazing off listlessly, evidently doing a private trip in her head. Her face, elongated and bony, had a strength to it. Probably, he decided, because the bones, especially the jaw lines, were pronounced. On her right cheek was a zit. Undoubtedly, she neither cared about nor noticed that, either. Like sex, zits meant little to her. Maybe she couldn't tell the difference. Maybe, to her, a long-time needle freak, sex and zits had similar or even identical qualities. What a thought, he thought, this glimpse into a hype's head for a moment.
Do you have a toothbrush I can use? Connie said. She had begun to nod a little and to mumble, as Hypes tended to do at this time of night.
Scrawled. Teeth or teeth, I'll brush him and
Her voice had sunk so low he couldn't hear her, although he knew from the movement of her lips that she was droning on.
Do you know where the bathroom is?
He asked her.
What bathroom?
In this house. Rousing herself, she resumed reflexively calming.
Who are those guys out there this late, rolling joints and rattling on and on? They live here with you, I guess.
Ah, sure they do. Guys like that must.
Two of them knew, Arctor said. Her dead codfish eyes turned to fix their gaze on him.
You queer? Connie asked.
I try not to be. That's why you're here tonight.
Are you putting up a pretty good battle against it?
You better believe it.
Connie nodded.
Yes, I suppose I'm about to find out. If you're, a latent gay, you won't want me to take the initiative.
All right, lie down and I'll do you.
You want me to, undress you?
Okay, you just lie there and I'll do it all.
She reached for his zipper.
Later in the semi-darkness, he drowsed from, so to speak, his own fix. Connie snored on beside him, lying on her back with her arms at her sides outside the covers. He could see her dimly.
They sleep like Count Dracula, he thought. Junkies do.
Staring straight up until all of a sudden they sit up, like a machine cranked from position A to position B.
It must be day,
the junkie says, or anyhow the tape in his head says.
Plays him his instructions, the mind of a junkie being like the music you hear on a clock radio. It sometimes sounds pretty, but it is only there to make you do something. The music from the clock radio is to wake you up. The music from the junkie is to get you to become a means for him to obtain more junk, in whatever way you can serve. He, a machine, will turn you into his machine. Every junkie, he thought, is a recording. Again he dozed, meditating about these bad things. And eventually the junkie, if it's a chick, has nothing to sell but her body. Like Connie, he thought. Connie right here. Opening his eyes, he turned toward the girl beside him and saw Donna Hawthorne. Instantly, he sat up. Donna, he thought. He could make out her face clearly, no doubt. Christ, he thought, and reached for the bedside light. His fingers touched it. The lamp tumbled and fell. The girl, however, slept on. He still stared at her, and then by degrees he saw Connie again. Hatchet-faced, bleak-jawed, sunken, the gaunt face of the out-of-it junkie. Connie and not Donna. One girl and not the other. He lay back and, miserable, slept somewhat again, wondering what it meant and so forth and on into darkness.
I don't care if he stunk, the girl beside him muttered later on dreamily in her sleep. I still love him.
He wondered who she meant. A boyfriend? Her father? A tomcat? A childhood precious stuffed toy? Maybe all of them, he thought. But the words were, I loved, not I still love. Evidently he, whatever or whoever he had been, was gone now. Maybe, Arctor reflected, they, whoever they were, had made her throw him out, because he stank so bad. Probably so. He wondered how old she had been then, the remembering worn-out junkie girl who dozed beside him.
Chapter 10. In his scramble suit, Fred sat before a battery of whirling hollow playbacks, watching Jim Barris and Bob Arctor's living room reading a book on mushrooms. Why mushrooms? Fred wondered, and sped the tapes at high speed forward to an hour later. There sat Barris yet, reading with great concentration and making notes. Presently, Barris set the book down and left the house, passing out of scanning range. When he returned, he carried a little brown paper bag, which he set on the coffee table and opened. From it he removed dried mushrooms, which he then began to compare one by one with the color photos in the book. With excessive deliberation, unusual for him, he compared each. At last, he pushed one miserable-looking mushroom aside and restored the others to the bag. From his pocket, he brought forth a handful of empty capsules and then, with equally great precision, began crumbling bits of the one particular mushroom into the caps and sealing each of them in turn. After that, Barris started phoning. The phone tap automatically recorded the numbers called.
Hello, this is Jim.
So?
Say, have I scored.
No shit.
Psilocybe mexicana.
What's that?
A rare hallucinogenic mushroom used in South American mystery cults thousands of years ago.
You fly. You become invisible.
Understand the speech of animals.
No thanks. Click. Redialing.
Hello, this is Jim.
Jim? Jim who?
With the beard. Green shades, leather pants. I met you at a happening over at Wanda...
Oh, yeah, Jim, yeah.
You interested in scoring on some organic psychedelics?
Well, I don't know.
Unease.
You sure this is Jim? You don't sound like him.
Well, I've got something unbelievable. A rare organic mushroom from South America, used in Indian mystery cults thousands of years ago. You fly, become invisible, your car disappears. You are able to understand the speech of animals.
My car disappears all the time. Yeah, you know, when I leave it in the tow-away zone. Ha ha.
I can lay perhaps 6 caps of this psilocybe on you.
How much?
$5 a cap.
Outrageous! No kidding? Hey, I'll meet you somewhere.
Then suspicion.
Well, you know, I believe I remember you. You burned me once. Where'd you get these mushroom hits? How do I know they're not weak acid?
They were brought to the U.S. inside a clay idol, Barris said, as part of a carefully guarded art shipment to a museum with this one idol marked. The customs pigs never suspected, Barris added. If they don't get you off, I'll refund your money.
Well, that's meaningless if my head's been eaten and I'm swinging through the trees.
I dropped one 2 days ago myself, Barris said, to test it out. The best trip I ever had. Lots of colors. Better than mescaline, for sure. I don't want my customers burned. I always test my stuff myself. It's guaranteed.
Behind Fred, another scramble suit was watching the holo monitor now, too.
What's he peddling? Mescaline, he says?
He's been capping mushrooms, Fred said, that either he picked or someone else picked locally. Some mushrooms are toxic in the extreme, the scramble suit behind Fred said. A third scramble suit knocked off its own hollow scrutiny for a moment and stood with them now.
Certain Amanita mushrooms contain 4 toxins that are red blood cell cracking agents. It takes 2 weeks to die and there's no antidote. It's incalculably painful. Only an expert can tell what mushroom is picking for sure when they're wild.
Yeah, I know, Fred said, and marked the indent numbers of the tape section for department use. Barris again was dialing.
What's the statute violation cited on this? Fred said.
Misrepresentation in advertising,
one of the other scramble suits said, and both laughed and returned to their own screens. Fred continued watching.
On Hollow Monitor 4, the front door of the house opened and Bob Arctor entered, looking dejected.
Hi.
Howdy, Barris said, gathering his caps together and thrusting them deep into his pocket.
How'd you make out with Donna?
He chuckled.
In several ways, maybe, eh?
Okay, fuck off, Arctor said, and passed from Hollow Monitor 4 to be picked up in his bedroom a moment later by Scanner 5. There, with the door kicked shut, Arctor brought forth a number of plastic bags filled with white tabs. He stood a moment, uncertainly, and then he stuffed them down under the covers of his bed, out of sight, and took off his coat. He appeared weary and unhappy. His face was drawn. For a moment, Bob Arctor sat on the edge of his unmade bed, all by himself. He at last shook his head, rose, stood uncertain. Then he smoothed his hair and left the room, to be picked up by the central living room scanner as he approached Barris. During this time, Scanner 2 had witnessed Barris hiding the brown bag of mushrooms under the couch cushions and placing the mushroom textbook back on the bookshelf where it was not noticeable.
What you been doing? Arctor asked him.
Barris declared,
research.
And what?
The properties of certain mycological entities of a delicate nature. Barris chuckled. Well, it didn't go too well with Little Miss Big Tits, did it?
Arctor regarded him, and then went into the kitchen to plug in the coffee pot.
Bob, Barris said, following him leisurely, I'm sorry if I said anything that offended you.
He hung around as Arctor waited for the coffee to heat, drumming and humming aimlessly. Where's Luckman?
Oh, I suppose out somewhere trying to rip off a payphone. He took your hydraulic axle jack with him.
Well, that usually means he's out to knock over a payphone, doesn't it?
My axle jack, Arctor echoed.
You know, Barris said, I could assist you professionally in your attempts to hustle, Little Miss...
Fred shot the tape ahead at high-speed wind. The meter at last read a 2-hour passage.
Pay up your goddamn back rent, or goddamn get to work on the cephscope, Arctor was saying hotly to Barris.
I've already ordered resistors, which...
Again, Fred sent the tape forward. 2 more hours passed. Now, Hollow Monitor 5 showed Arctor in his bedroom, in bed, a clock FM radio on to KNX, playing folk rock dimly. Monitor 2 in the living room showed Barris alone, again reading about mushrooms. Neither man did much for a long period. Once, Arctor stirred and reached out to increase the radio's volume as a song, evidently one he liked, came on. In the living room, Barris read on and on, hardly moving. Arctor again at last lay back in bed, unmoving. The phone rang. Barris reached out and lifted it to his ear.
Hello?
On the phone tap, the caller, a male, said,
Mr. Arctor?
Yes, this is, Barris said.
I'll be fucked for a nanny goat, Fred said to himself. He reached to turn up the phone tap volume level.
Mr. Arctor,
the unidentified caller said in a slow, low voice.
I'm sorry to bother you so late, but that check of yours that did not clear...
Oh, yes, Barris said. I've been intending to call you about that. The situation is this, sir. I have had a severe bout of intestinal flu, with loss of body heat, pyloric spasms, cramps. I just can't get it all together right now to make that little $20 check good, and frankly, I don't intend to make it good.
What?
The man said, not startled, but hoarsely, ominously.
Yes, sir, Barris said, nodding. You heard me correctly, sir.
Mr. Arctor, the caller said. That check has been returned by the bank twice now, and these flu symptoms that you describe...
I think somebody slipped me something bad, Barris said with a stark grin on his face.
I think, the man said, that you're one of those...
He groped for the word.
Think what you want, Barris said, still grinning.
Mr. Arctor...
the man said, breathing audibly into the phone.
I am going to the DA's office with that check, and while I'm on the phone, I have a couple of things to tell you about what I feel about...
Turn on, tune out, and goodbye, Barris said, and hung up.
The phone tap unit had automatically recorded the digits of the caller's own phone, picking them up electronically from an inaudible signal generated as soon as the circuit was in place. Fred read off the number now visible on a meter, then shut off the tape transport for all his holo scanners, lifted his own police phone, and called in for a printout on the number.
Angelson Locksmith, 1343 Harbor in Anaheim,
the police info operator informed him.
Lover boy.
Locksmith, Fred said. Okay. He had that written down now and hung up. A locksmith. $20, a round sum. That suggested a job outside the shop, probably driving out and making a duplicate key, when the owner's key had gotten lost. Theory. Barris had posed as Arctor, phoned Engelson Locksmith to have a duplicate key made illicitly for either the house or the car or even both, telling Engelson he'd lost his whole key ring. But then the locksmith, doing a security check, had sprung on Barris a request for a check as ID. Barris had gone back in the house and ripped off an unfilled-out checkbook of Arctor's and written a check out on it to the locksmith. The check hadn't cleared. But why not? Arctor kept a high balance in his account. A check that small would clear. But if it cleared, Arctor would come across it in his statement and recognize it as not his, as Jim Barris's. So Barris had rooted about in Arctor's closets and located, probably at some previous time, an old checkbook from a now-abandoned account and used that. The account being closed, the check hadn't cleared. Now Barris was in hot water. But why didn't Barris just go in and pay off the check in cash? This way, the creditor was already mad and phoning, and eventually would take it to the DA. Arctor would find out. A sky full of shit would land on Barris. But the way Barris had talked on the phone to the already outraged creditor, he had slyly goaded him into even further hostility, out of which the locksmith might do anything. And worse, Barris's description of his flu was a description of coming off heroin, and anybody would know who knew anything. And Barris had signed off the phone call with a flat-out insinuation that he was a heavy doper, and so what about it? Signed all this off as Bob Arctor. The locksmith, at this point, knew he had a junkie debtor who'd written him a rubber check and didn't care shit and had no intention of making good. And the junkie had this attitude because obviously he was so wired and spaced and mind-blown on his dope it didn't matter to him. And this was an insult to America. Deliberate and nasty. In fact, Barris's sign-off was a direct quote of Tim Leary's original funky ultimatum to the establishment and all the straights. And this was Orange County, full of birchers and minutemen, with guns, looking for just this kind of uppity sass from bearded dopers. Barris had set Bob Arctor up for a firebombing. A bust on the bad check, at least. A firebombing or other massive retaliatory strike at worst, without Arctor having any notion what was coming down. Why? Fred wondered. He noted on a scratch pad the ident code on this tape sequence, plus the phone tap code as well. What was Barris getting Arctor back for? What the hell had Arctor been up to? Arctor must have burned him pretty bad, Fred thought, for this. This is sheer malice. Little vile and evil. This Barris guy, he thought, is a motherfucker. He's gonna get somebody killed. One of the scramble suits in the safe apartment with him roused him from his introspection. Do you actually know these guys? The suit gestured at the now blank hollow monitors Fred had before him. Are you in there among them on cover assignment? Yep, Fred said. It wouldn't be a bad idea to warn them in some way about this mushroom toxicity he's exposing them to, that clown with the green shades who's peddling. Can you pass it on to them without faulting your cover? The other near-scramble suit called from his swivel chair. Any time one of them gets violently nauseous, that's sometimes a tip-off on mushroom poisoning. Resembling strychnine, Fred said. A cold insight grappled with his head then. A rerun of the Kimberly Hawkins dog shit day and his illness in his car after what... his. I'll tell Arctor, he said. I can lay it on him, without him flashing on me. He's docile. Ugly looking, too, one of the scramble suits said. He, the individual, came in the door stoop-shouldered and hung over. Oh, Fred said, and swiveled back to his hollows. Oh, God damn, he thought. That day Barris gave us the tabs at the roadside. His mind went into spins and double trips and then split in half, directly down the middle. The next thing he knew, he was in the safe apartment's bathroom with a Dixie cup of water, rinsing at his mouth by himself where he could think. When you get down to it, I'm Arctor, he thought. I'm the man on the scanners, the suspect Barris was fucking over with his weird phone call with the locksmith. And I was asking, what's Arctor been up to get Barris on him like that? I'm sloshed. My brain is sloshed. This is not real. I'm not believing this. Watching what is me is Fred. That was Fred down there without his scramble suit. That's how Fred appears, without the suit. And Fred, the other day, possibly almost got it with toxic mushroom fragments, he realized. He almost didn't make it here to this safe apartment to get these hollows going. But now he has. Now Fred has a chance, but only barely.
Crazy goddamn job they gave me, he thought. But if I wasn't doing it, someone else would be. And they might get it wrong. They'd set him up. Set Arctor up. They'd turn him in for the reward. They'd plant dope on him and collect. If anyone, he thought, has to be watching that house, it better ought to be me by far, despite the disadvantages. And just protecting everybody against kinky fucking Barris in itself justifies it right there. And if any other officer monitoring Barris's actions sees what I probably will see, they'll conclude Arctor is the biggest drug runner in the western U.S. and recommend a, Christ, covert snuff by our unidentified forces. The ones in black we borrow from back east that tiptoe a lot and carry the scope sight Winchester 803s. The new infrared sniper scope sights synced with the EE trophic shells. Those guys who don't get paid at all, even from a Dr. Pepper machine. They just get to draw straws to see which of them gets to be the next U.S. president. My God, he thought. Those fuckers can shoot down a passing plane and make it look like one engine inhaled a flock of birds. Those EE trophic shells. Why, fuck me, man, he thought. They'd leave traces of feathers in the ruins of the engines. They'd prime them for that. This is awful, he thought, thinking about this. Not Arctor as suspect, but Arctor as whatever. Target. I'll keep on watching him. Fred will keep on doing his Fred thing. It'll be a lot better. I can edit and interpret and do a great deal of let's wait until he actually and so on, and realizing this, he tossed the Dixie cup away and emerged from the safe apartment's bathroom. You look done in, one of the scramble suits said to him. Well, Fred said, funny thing happened to me on the way to the grave. He saw in his mind a picture of the supersonic tight beam projector which had caused a 49-year-old district attorney to have a fatal cardiac arrest, just as he was about to reopen the case of a dreadful and famous political assassination here in California. I almost got there, he said aloud. Almost is almost, the scramble suit said. It's not there. Oh, Fred said. Yeah, right. Sit down, the scramble suit said. And get back to work. Or for you, no Friday. Just public assistance. Can you imagine listing this job as a job skill on the... Fred began. But the two other scramble suits were not amused and, in fact, weren't even listening. So, he reseated himself and lit a cigarette and started up the battery of hollows once more. What I ought to do, he decided, is walk back up the street to the house right now while I'm thinking about it, before I get sidetracked, and walk in on Barris real fast and shoot him, in the line of duty. I'll say, hey man, I'm hurting, can you lay a joint on me? I'll pay you a buck. And he will. And then I'll arrest him, drag him to my car, throw him inside, drive onto the freeway, and then pistol whip him out of the car in front of a truck. And I can say he fought loose and tried to jump. Happens all the time. Because if I don't, I can never eat or drink any open food or beverage in the house, and neither can Luckman or Donna or Freck, or we'll all croak from toxic mushroom fragments, after which Barris will explain about how we were all out in the woods picking them at random and eating them, and he tried to dissuade us, but we wouldn't listen because we didn't go to college. Even if the court psychiatrists find him totally burned out and nuts and toss him in forever, somebody will be dead. He thought, maybe Donna, for instance. Maybe she'll wander in, spaced on hash, looking for me in the spring flowers I promised her. And Barris will offer her a bowl of jello he made himself special. And 10 days later she'll be thrashing in agony in an intensive care ward, and it won't do any good then. If that happens, he thought, I'll boil him in Drano, in the bathtub in hot Drano, until only bones remain. And then mail the bones to his mother or kids, whichever he has. And if he hasn't either, then just toss the bones out at passing dogs. But the deed will be done to that little girl anyhow. Excuse me, he rolled in his head in fantasy to the other two scramble suits. Where can I get 100-pound can of Drano this time of night? I've had it, he thought, and turned on the hollow so as not to attract any more static from the other suits in the safe room. On monitor 2, Barris was talking to Luckman,
who apparently had rolled in the front door dead drunk, no doubt on Ripple.
There are more people addicted to alcohol in the U.S., Barris was telling Luckman, who was trying to find the door to his bedroom to go pass out and having a terrible time. Then there are addicts of all other forms of drugs. And brain damage and liver damage from the alcohol, plus impurities.
Luckman disappeared without ever having noticed Barris was there. I wish him luck, Fred thought. It's not a workable policy, though, not for long. Because the fucker is there. But now, Fred is here, too. But all Fred's got is hindsight. Unless, he thought, unless maybe I run the holotapes backward. Then I'd be there first, before Barris. What I do would precede what Barris does. If with me first he gets to do anything at all. And then the other side of his head opened up and spoke to him more calmly. Like another self, with a simpler message flashed to him as to how to handle it. The way to cool the locksmith check, it told him, is to go down there to Harbor tomorrow, first thing very early, and redeem the check and get it back. Do that first, before you do anything else. Do that right away. Diffuse that at that end. And after that, do the other more serious things once that's finished. Right? Right, he thought. That will remove me from the disadvantage list. That's where to start. He put the tape on fast forward, on and on, until he figured from the meters that it would show a night scene with everyone asleep, for a pretext to sign off his workday here. It now showed lights off, the scanners on infra. Luckman in his bed in his room, Barris in his, and in his room, Arctor beside a chick, both of them asleep. Let's see, Fred thought. Something. We have her in the computer files as strung out on hard stuff and also turning tricks and dealing. A true loser.
At least you didn't have to watch your subject have sexual intercourse, one of the other scramble suits said, watching from behind him and then passing on by.
That's a relief, Fred said, stoically viewing the two sleeping figures in the bed. His mind was on the locksmith and what he had to do there. I always hate it.
A nice thing to do, the scramble suit agreed. But not too nice to watch.
Arctor asleep, Fred thought, with his trick. Well, I can wind up soon. They'll undoubtedly bawl on arising, but that's about it for them. He continued watching, however. The sight of Bob Arctor sleeping. On and on, Fred thought, hour after hour. And then he noticed something he had not noticed. That doesn't look like anybody else but Donna Hawthorne. He thought, there in bed, in the sack with Arctor. That doesn't compute, he thought, and reached to snap off the scanners. He ran the tape back, then forward again. Bob Arctor and a chick, but not Donna. It was the junkie chick, Connie. He had been right. The two individuals lay there side by side, both asleep. And then, as Fred watched, Connie's hard features melted and faded into softness. And into Donna Hawthorne's face. He snapped off the tape again, sat puzzled. I don't get it, he thought. It's, what do they call that, like a goddamn dissolve, a film technique. Fuck, what is this? Pre-editing for TV viewing? By a director using special visual effects? Again, he ran the tape back, then forward. When he first came to the alteration in Connie's features, he then stopped the transport, leaving the hologram filled with one freeze frame. He rotated the enlarger, all the other cubes cut out. One huge cube formed from the previous eight. A single nocturnal scene. Bob Arctor unmoving in his bed, the girl unmoving beside him. Standing, Fred walked into the hollow cube, into the three-dimensional projection, and stood close to the bed to scrutinize the girl's face. Halfway between, he decided. Still half Connie, already half Donna. I better run this over to the lab, he thought. It's been tampered with by an expert. I've been fed fake tape. Who by? He wondered. He emerged from the hollow cube, collapsed it, and restored the small eight ones. Still sat there, pondering. Somebody faked in Donna, superimposed over Connie, forged evidence that Arctor was laying the Hawthorne girl, Why? As a good technician can do with either audio or videotape, and now, as witness, with holotapes. Hard to do, but... If this was a click-on, click-off interval scan, he thought, we'd have a sequence showing Arctor in bed with a girl he probably never did get into bed and never will, but there it is on the tape. Or maybe it's a visual interruption or breakdown electronically, he pondered. What they call printing. Holo printing. From one section of the tape storage to another. If the tape sits too long, if the recording gain was too high initially, it prints across. Geez, he thought. It printed Donna across from a previous or later scene, maybe from the living room. I wish I knew more about the technical side of this, he reflected. I'd better acquire more background on this before jumping the gun. Like another AM station, filtering in, interfering. Crosstalk, he decided. Like that. Accidental. Like ghosts on the TV screen. Functional. A malfunction. A transducer opened up briefly. Again, he rolled the tape. Connie again, and Connie it stayed. And then, again, Fred saw Donna's face melt back in, and this time, the sleeping man beside her in the bed, Bob Arctor, woke up after a moment and sat up abruptly, then fumbled for the light beside him. The light filled to the floor, and Arctor was staring on and on at the sleeping girl, at sleeping Donna. When Connie's face seeped back, Arctor relaxed, and at last he sank back and again slept, but restlessly. Well, that shoots down the technical interference theory, Fred thought, printing or crosstalk. Arctor saw it, too. Woke up, saw it, stared, then gave up. Christ, Fred thought, and shut off the equipment before him entirely. I guess that's enough for me for now, he declared, and rose shakily to his feet. I've had it. Saw some kinky sex, did you? The scramble suit asked. Well, you'll get used to this job. I never will get used to this job, Fred said. You can make book on that.